conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. Dialogue Conspiracy number 269, and it's May the 16th, 1977. We're just about going into the Gemini sign. I'm very favorable to that time of the year. I have many friends that are Gemini. I happen to be born May 29th, the same day as John Kennedy. I want to talk today about two Geminis that were important in the shape of our history, American history. One is Ian Fleming, born May 28th, 1908, and the other is Malcolm X, born May 19th, 1925. There are many Geminis here at KLRB. George, Genial, Chuck, Steve, Vicki is on the cusp. She has a birthday tomorrow. And Noreen used to work here, and Bill Goldsmith, they were Geminis. There used to be a time where there were a whole gang of Geminis here at one time, and there still are quite a few Geminis at this station. And it is one of my favorite signs. My favorite authors, Thoreau and Walt Whitman, were Geminis, and Bob Dylan was a Gemini, and I'm very partial to that sign. And many, many of my close friends, very closest friends, just coincidentally all happened to be Geminis. I don't know how it worked out that way, but that's the way it is. And after we got to know each other and we compared birthdays, it fell on that particular season or time. I am interested in Ian Fleming. As I say, he was born May 28th in 1909, and he was the author of all the James Bond stories, his famous James Bond 007. You get the number 007 for the ability to kill. That's the permission that the British intelligence gave for the right to murder, and that's how he got the number 007. He really claimed that he hadn't killed. He had devised many plots and schemes for the intelligence community, but one of the tests in order to get that number 007 is that you have to walk into a room where somebody is sitting and you don't know that person. You have to open the door and just kill them. And when it came time for him to open the door, he failed that test, so he says, and went into the schemes and plans, but never was able to open the door and just kill that particular person on the spot. But I think the life of Ian Fleming is interesting, where he came from and how he got into the James Bond stories, and even the story of his death and the violence around his death. Because a lot of times we read these books or see his movies and really don't realize the importance that he played in the particular time that he lived. He came from a very, very wealthy family. His grandfather was Robert Fleming, who was a multimillionaire, who founded his own bank. His grandfather founded the Robert Fleming Company in the City of London, England. It's still a banking firm there. And he received a lot of money. At the time of the Civil War, he was very wealthy. And he came to the United States and became what they called the father of investment trusts, and where a capitalist could take joint investments and go into the world of high finance by combining their money into these forms of trust. His grandfather died in 1933, the same year that Adolf Hitler got elected into office. But he was a prominent man who was an equal to the Pierpont Morgans and Jacob Schiff and the other financiers who, not coincidentally, had helped put Adolf Hitler into power. He crossed the Atlantic 122 times, was high into American finances and the complications that go with it, and also reach out into our infamous wars, World War I and II. He completed the financial reconstruction of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, the Denver and Rio Grande Railroads, and he also had interest in constructing the Cuba Railroads. This is interesting because his grandson plays a role later in terms of the Bay of Pigs operations with the CIA and British intelligence. His family still gather on 100,000 acres in a forest, the surviving members, every summer, their Scottish clan. Some of them are dead now, but the surviving still meet every year. The grandfather also banked the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and later Ian Fleming was to go over to Kuwait and work with the oil companies over there. He backed the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and he had two sons, Philip and Valentin. The grandfather had two sons, Valentin and Philip, and Valentin was the father of Ian Fleming. He was born to Valentin. Valentin, whose father was the banker who went to America, who worked with the American financiers, who helped finance and capitalize the Reconstruction of America after the Civil War. His son went to Eton and then to Harvard, to Oxford, rather, and was a close personal friend of Winston Churchill, who, again, played a major part in World War II in England. And Valentin was in Parliament. He was a member of Parliament. And he gave birth, his wife gave birth to a son May 28, 1908. And that was Ian Fleming, the son of Valentine Fleming, the grandson of Robert Fleming, the important multi-millionaire financier. Ian Fleming went to Eton. He went to a university in Zurich. He went to the Royal Military College. He was a person of high emotions, mystery, and imagination, described as the kind of child who could go into espionage work when he was a little bit older. He went to the Munich University, claimed to be apolitical. He was at the Munich University at the time of Hitler's rise to power, and had a lot of interest in the activities in Munich, Germany. Particularly, he learned to read Russian in the periods of 1928 and 29. He was mastering the Russian Revolution. Now, taken in those time slots, which is important, because now every time I read an article, read a book, I have sort of a chart of time periods, and it makes the explanations of events more interesting, knowing the role that his grandfather had and father had in Parliament and the role that his son had in learning Russian. At this particular time slot, and turns out to be one of the most notorious and heads of secret British intelligence and secret operations, who later forms our Secret Service. His claim to fame was training our Secret Service that guarded our presidents. You know what a good job they did. America changed its name in Dallas, and I feel that the Secret Service training could have very easily been done by Mr. James Bond, Ian Fleming, as I look back at the protection our public officials have had. But in 1928-29, you could see that this multimillionaire, the son, grandson of this financier, was in Germany studying Russian at a time when Germany was very carefully rearming to invade Russia, and Adolf Hitler was being groomed as the person who would represent the financiers as being the military man to go into Russia to take back their holdings for the White Russians and the Solidarists and the extremely wealthy people that were forced to leave when the Tsar was kicked out and the revolution took place in Russia. He studied his Russian and then went April 6, 1933, from Berlin to Moscow and worked for Reuters News Agency 1929 to 1933 in Russia. This is James Bond, Ian Fleming. That James Bond was his literary name. When he came out from Moscow, he went immediately to Navy Intelligence, where he's described as having a finger in virtually everything that happened in British intelligence. He knew more secrets, had more real power than most of the senior officials in all of the three services. He was promoted to lieutenant commander and then full commander, and then he made special contacts between what was clear Navy intelligence and then what was the cloak and dagger department of the Special Operations Executive. During World War II, we had the OSS, which later became the CIA immediately after World War II, but England had its Special Operations Executive, and Ian Fleming went directly to that and was a liaison of Navy intelligence to their Special Operations. And it was his task, with his genius and imagination and his expertise in world affairs and languages, to set up what they called irregular operations. This is terribly important in studying the whole history of our era, because the John Kennedy assassination fits into one time slot. He was only one person of many, many people that were to be killed and will be killed. And the background of those that laid the plans was very carefully done with some of the best minds available, but also not disinterested. This young person's grandfather, as I say, built railroads in Cuba. He was a financier, one of the top movers of the financial world between England and America, and the grandson went to school to master Russian, went to Moscow, and then to Navy operations. And then he was in contact with the military intelligence in England, so he was involved with Navy intelligence, Special Operations Executive, and then the M16, the notorious military intelligence section. So there was the Army, the Navy, and the Special Operations. So that he was involved in what is described as the black world of special operations, SOE, Special Operations Executive. then sent to the Middle East to carry on. Ian Fleming went in 1941 to North Africa in the role of Navy intelligence. Then he came to the United States, where he helped set up, along with Sir William Stevenson from British intelligence, who was living in Canada. They set up their headquarters called Intrepid in the Rockefeller Building, 34th floor of the Rockefeller Building in New York City. It was here in the United States that Ian Fleming met J. Edgar Hoover in 1941, who was the vicious, notorious anti-communist who, along with these people, despised the Tsar, the Russian Revolution, who wanted to cut off the heads of everybody he suspected of being sympathetic to the communists. J. Edgar Hoover later, a few years later, is to become vice president of Interpol, which would include former Nazis that were planning the extermination of many, many people that they hadn't accomplished before World War II was over, and their lists were maintained by the notorious Interpol. And it was at this time, in 1941, that Ian Fleming met J. Edgar Hoover, and J. Edgar Hoover was working with Canadian millionaire Sir William Stevenson, who is known as the codename Intrepid. Canada is important in this because of the unpublished document that I refer to from time to time called the Torbett Manuscript, which I'll go on a little bit in regards to the assassination teams, because the allegation of a lawyer in the Southwest is that the assassinations were planned in Montreal, funded by an organization called Permandex outside of Switzerland. But the planning, the money for the assassinations came from Canada and into Swiss banks and washed many, many ways, but siphoned down to Jamaica, to Montego Bay, where Mr. Fleming is going to move later. He sets up his headquarters. As I say, June 1941 at Rockefeller Center is when the FBI and the British intelligence combine. The role of Ian Fleming in the Rockefeller Building is barely described in Casino Royale. They're testing him with the license to kill with the 00 number in advance. He had many jobs. He duplicated the keys in the office. He helped break codes. And he also claimed, as I said, that he had a role in starting our American Secret Service, referring to the bodyguards around the president. And this was to be put into the Treasury Department. We know, and I've read many times on KLRB, not enough, maybe the terrible protection of John Kennedy, the Lawton testimony in the Warren Commission hearings, the inadequate protection of John Kennedy. And then I've made the allegations because of good researchers like Ted Sharrock in Los Angeles, who has made the movie The Second Gun and tells about the protective care that Robert Kennedy had, the Ambassador Hotel, and the allegations that Thane Caesar, the bodyguard, actually did the fatal shots to Robert Kennedy when he was running for president. And we also know about the bodyguards around Martin Luther King and candidate George Wallace. So it's understandable how the bodyguards fall apart if 007 Ian Fleming set up the American Secret Service system for the protection of the president. Ian Fleming was excellent at underwater exercises. He was very good at sports. He was a good shot with small arms, submarine guns, judo, self-defense, planting bombs. And later in his life, he wasn't too old, fairly young, he accepted an offer from a Lord Kemsley, who owned a newspaper chain, to set up a foreign news service for the chain. And he had national and provincial newspapers. And the role of newspaper man came to Ian Fleming, and then he moved down to the Jamaica, where he had a home that he alternated with England. Now, the Torbett document maintains that Ian Fleming came down to the Southwest after World War II in the Bahamas to reorganize and set up the Nazi cartel, the Nazi headquarters, for after World War II was over. Literally, it works its way into World War III eventually. The biography of Ian Fleming, The Life of Ian Fleming, written by John Pearson in 1966, doesn't mention at all why a well-known newspaper man who has a chain would hire Ian Fleming at this time or what he did for him. It's interesting because this seems to be the cover. He came home from the Reuters job in Moscow and went to work for the London Times. And Kim Philby, who probably is the most famous spy in the world outside of Ian Fleming, worked under the cover of getting into intelligence through the London Times also. The newspapers seem to be a good cover ground. But the story is that he was hired by the newspaper man Lord Kemsley, and then he went to Jamaica in 1946 to build a home that's known as Goldeneye. It's literally a ghost house now. The Goldeneye is where Ian Fleming built a house on Motego Bay in Jamaica. And Motego Bay is a place described as a secret compound where Golly Clark and Max Clark, the first contacts that Lee Harvey Oswald had when he returned the Dallas-Fort Worth area, had a home. John Conley has a home down there. There's a secret compound with their own landing bases and their own social circle of the intelligence agents from the United States and Britain and from all over the world is set down in Motego Bay in Jamaica. And this is where Ian Fleming went in 1946. That was the year when Howard Hughes and the Bank of America and Aerospace Industries were setting up particular men in Congress to vote in 1947 for the National Security Council, which set up our CIA in this country with the help of people like Ian Fleming and William Stevenson and Reinhard Gehlen from Germany, Nazi intelligence. They formed our CIA. 1946 was the year that Richard Nixon went to the House of Representatives, that Gerald Ford was sent to the House of Representatives. Both Ford was appointed to the Warren Commission by Richard Nixon later. Hale Boggs on the Warren Commission went from Louisiana to the House. Dick Russell went into Congress in 1946. John Cooper from the Warren Commission came in 1946, and George Smathers, with his links to B.B. Rabozo and the youth organizations in the Southwest, came in. It was a very heavy year. Goodness knows how many more people. I haven't even documented the dates that these diehards went into Congress, but I know that people surrounding the Kennedy assassination and the investigation and cover of it came in 1946, and the National Security Council was started in 1947. And strategically, Mr. Ian Fleming is down in Jamaica, where many people involved with Lee Harvey Oswald, later directly involved with Lee Harvey Oswald, were at Motego Bay in Jamaica. For example, the Torbett document says that Albert Osborne, the gentleman that accompanied Lee Harvey Oswald on a bus to Mexico, went to Motego Bay for money and orders that a double of Oswald's by the name of Don Norton picked up in Montreal, Canada, and brought the money south, and then it went to Motego Bay, and Albert Osborne was there, and he later then went to accompany Lee Harvey Oswald on a bus from, it was from Texas, New Orleans to Texas, and then down into Mexico. The Motego Bay interweaves into a lot of research and documents now, and it hasn't gotten enough publicity, and I think it should, and this is why I did want to talk about it. But it's interesting that the home that was built for Ian Fleming down there, Goldeneye, was very secure and secretive and was not like a residential dwelling. It's been described in various ways, but hardly a place of warmth or a place where he could curl up and do a normal resort kind of living. Very many famous people have been there. Noel Coward and I believe Princess Margaret, a lot of famous people have been entertained there. Ian Fleming studied very carefully through the Germans and through the British what they call the cell system, in which they carefully study series of contacts of spies and set up conditions of secrecy and introductions. And a lot of this is written into many of his books, like To Russia with Love, The Moonraker, To Live and Let Die, Casino Royale, Goldfinger. You all know the James Bond stories. Everything that he wrote in these stories was true, and that may have been his undoing. He felt that before he died, that James Bond would kill him, that maybe he had written too much. And there are several articles out intimating that he had an idea that he would die, and he died young. And although he smoked a lot of cigarettes and drank a lot of whiskey, he lived pretty hard. But he still felt that James Bond would kill him, that the spy would kill him, and that he had gone too far. He had given some suggestions for Alan Dulles and the CIA for how to undo Castro at the time of Bay of Pigs. And they were all kind of humorous and flippant, but it's the kind of thing that gets into books, and the hard work that he possibly had with the invasion of Cuba is not available yet. I don't know if it's any documents that will come out of the National Archives. He suggested sending Cubans a lot of money and telling them it's a compliment to the United States, and with this they wouldn't become communists. That's actually a pretty good idea. Then he said to use Guantanamo base and have religious manifestations and crosses, that the only thing the Cubans cared about was money, religion, and sex. And they should have some electronic crosses or something in the sky so they'd all be looking skyward all the time. And then his third idea was to send planes over Cuba with pamphlets that the atomic bomb testing of the United States settled radioactivity in the beards of people, and that they should cut off their beards. He said with no beards there'd be no revolution. It was all, the reports are kind of flippant about Ian Fleming's role in the invasion in Bay of Pigs, but as I say, it's yet to be documented what he really did know about the operation. In the autumn of 1960, he went to Kawat with the oil companies there. He was a guest of the oil companies. While he was there, he wrote another book called The State of Excitement, but this book is still suppressed. This is the only book of his that has not been allowed to be published. The book Diamonds Are Forever is an exact description of Howard Hughes' life in Las Vegas, or the way we think it would he would be living it if he were in Las Vegas. But the important suppression of this book in the oil company indicates that he probably was revealing too much, because the officials wouldn't let him take it out once it was completed. Ian Fleming kind of flew into fame in 1971, again through some kind of a leak in Life magazine that has been notorious for espionage purposes. For whatever purposes there are, they often broke stories. In March 17, 1971, there was a column about John Kennedy, and one of his favorite authors was Ian Fleming, which may or may not be true. But there was a lot of mystery about how Ian Fleming's name appeared on this list. He was a fairly new author, and the credit was given to Jacqueline Onassis, Jacqueline Kennedy at the time, who, according to Alan Dulles, said, "This is a book you, underlining you, should have, Mr. Director." Well, being as Alan Dulles and Ian Fleming and Reinhard Galen and Mr. Wild Bill Donovan of the CIA all knew each other very intimately, it's interesting that Jacqueline Kennedy would have to tell Alan Dulles about any book that Ian Fleming did, because he really kept pretty close tab of him anyway, and they worked with the same organizations. GoldenEye was the place where Ian Fleming went to write a lot of his books down in Jamaica when he took time out from British intelligence. It was the birthplace of James Bond. He wrote his first novels there. The house has been empty since 1964, a year after John Kennedy was killed. The house had no more purpose, and nobody has been in there since. They say it's somewhat haunted, and I think the timing is interesting because he knew so much about John Kennedy and the era of the Bay of Pigs, and with the rise of Hitler and his experiences in Russia and working for Reuters and British intelligence and making the plans and the modus operandi for conspiracies. The one thing I learned after I spent 8 years cross-filing the Warren Commission hearings, and there's 26 volumes, there's about 18,000 pages, and I tediously spent 8 years reading every single word and breaking it down into retyping about 28,000 pages, was to get a flavor or the actual facts of who Lee Harvey Oswald was, or who Jack Ruby was, or the security for the president. And while I studied all this evidence and the modus operandi of these different people and the way the Warren Commission asked questions and what they didn't ask, it became very clear at the end of 8 years that I could say, this is the way these assassinations happen. This is the script. I just spent this last weekend working on 30 divisions of the Malcolm X assassination, which I'll go into in a few minutes, and maybe continue next week. But once you take the formula of the assassinations, it's like a recipe, and I've said that before. There's a plan, and once you draw it out, it applies to every single one of these political assassinations. And somebody like Ian Fleming could be very useful to set the script for the John Kennedy assassination or the security of the president by 1963, and he could die in 64. And that formula or script could apply, whether it's Medgar Evers or Malcolm X or Whitney Young or Martin Luther King or the Chappaquiddick affair or the George Wallace shooting or the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, and many, many conspiracies that take place. You have this formula. In fact, I was talking to Paul Krasner, who published The Realists. I was talking to him on the telephone last night, and I said I was thinking of getting out a 30-page kind of blank-page book. You see these coloring books with the blank pages, and have a section, 30 different topics, like security, the witnesses that got away, the primary witnesses that were killed, the discrepancy in weapons, the motive and have a book with blank pages and 30 topics, and then you can take any conspiracy you want. As I say, whether it's a Patty Hearst kidnapping or the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby and the framing of Bruno Hauptmann or the conspiracy of Howard Hughes, where is Howard Hughes and who is he? If you take these various categories, you can solve just about any conspiracy with this formula and fill in the missing names and pieces, and it gives you questions of where to go. Well, that's the value of Ian Fleming's mind. He had the training, he had the mind, and he was high up with the German, British intelligence and the FBI and Division 5 of the FBI. Ian Fleming had another brother who was very talented. They're both equally extremely wealthy. His older brother, Peter, was a writer and historian, and he died under mysterious circumstances in 1971 in Scotland in a shooting. And then Ian Fleming had a son, David Fleming, and this was their only son. He died violently in 1975. There was an explosion on the grounds. This wasn't Ian Fleming's son. This was his nephew, Peter's only son. Peter died mysteriously in 1971, and then his only son died violently in 1975. There was a bomb thrown at the family mansion, and David was thrown 25 yards and killed. And the cause of the explosion was never known. So that Ian Fleming died in the 1960s after John Kennedy was dead. Then his brother died. Then the nephew died. So the history of the family is gone now. There are a lot of pieces to be answered, and I'm sure that it isn't in the documents of British intelligence. I'm sure you can't get them, or they're locked up for many, many years. Some of it's coming out, but not all of it. And I think the story of Ian Fleming is important because in the study of the Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King, the Robert Kennedy, the John Kennedy, the Martin Luther King, the explanation of the links have been linked to an organization called Permandex, and that is made up of these five prongs: the Eastern European Russians, the Tsars, the White Russians, headed by Jean de Menil, M-E-N-I-L, a Russian exile, a close friend of George de Morenschild, who died recently, and then the American Council of Christian Churches, headed by H.L. Hunt, who his name has come up recently, and his relationships to George de Morenschild. Then the Free Cuba Committee, which was the third prong of Permandex, headed by Carlos Prio Siqueiros, who died the same way as George de Morenschild, who was linked in the activities of the Kennedy assassination. Then the Syndicate and Gamblers, headed by Bobby Baker and well-known mafia families who used Jack Ruby to kill Patsy Lee Harvey Oswald. And then the fifth division of Permandex is the Security Division under NASA that was headed by Wernher von Braun, with their headquarters in Columbus, Ohio, on Broad Street. East Broad Street, 3990 East Broad Street in Columbus, Ohio, is the address of the Defense Industrial Security Command. And it was there that J. Edgar Hoover worked with William Sullivan. This is a different Sullivan. This is the same Sullivan that was named at Watergate for stealing papers from J. Edgar Hoover and giving them to John Ehrlichman and goodness knows who. He was the head of Division 5 of the FBI. There are other William Sullivans in various police departments and FBI departments that I've studied, but this William Sullivan was the head of Division 5, who had a convenient little heart attack and retired at the time of the Watergate stories, and whose name has been taken out of the news. J. Edgar Hoover's interest in all of the anti-communist activity took place since he was director of the FBI since 1924. And of course, Ian Fleming's father, grandfather were coming to America. His father was a member of parliament, as I say, with Winston Churchill. And then Ian went into the intelligence, British Navy, military, and secret operations. And there's reason in my mind to believe that he died shortly after John Kennedy died, and that the formula or the recipe for the assassinations could very well have come out of his head, out of his imagination and his training, and then he no longer needed to exist. He did fear his own death, and he feared that he knew too much, and he did die shortly after John Kennedy was dead. And so with him go many, many secrets of the whole Cold War era. Another Gemini that I did want to talk about for the remaining of the time, and maybe is again, I keep saying next week I'll continue, some of these, I bring in too much information as usual, and then each week I get caught up in that news. Malcolm X, I do want to talk a little bit about him because the anniversary of his birthday is May 19th, 3 days from now, at 1925, and he, of course, he died very young. He was murdered February 22nd, 1965. He was just 40 years old when he died. There are as many unanswered questions about the murder of Malcolm X as there are of all the other assassinations. It was not a clear-cut case at all, and there were discrepancies in the testimony, the police forcing witnesses to testify what they didn't want to say, and intimidating witnesses, and lack of protection for Malcolm X. The American Opinion article, the Birch Society, came right out as soon as he was dead and called him literally a no-good slum, a scum, you know, that he'd been to prison and a narcotic addict and peddled a hoax that he was a leader and made money off of it. And they derided him, and they used a black man to do it, and the description was disgusting. Actually, Malcolm X was a very brilliant man. He had raised himself up by his bootstraps. He had seen their house burned out. He was brought up in Omaha, and the house had burned. They'd moved to Detroit. His father was murdered. The Klan was after them, even in the North. He realized that America couldn't go very far with the situation, the racism with the blacks. So he got the idea of taking the U.S. racism problem to the United Nations, and that was one of his big reasons, I think, that he was murdered, that he wanted to show the inconsistency of what America says or its constitution and what it really does. And he went to Africa, where he was very popular, and talked about racism in the United States and asked the Africans to bring the subject up to the United Nations about racism here. Another point that he had a lot of courage to speak about was when John Kennedy was killed. And the break of Malcolm X with the Muslims in Chicago came when he spoke up and Kennedy was murdered. At the time, he belonged to the sect of Elijah Muhammad in Chicago, but when Kennedy was killed, he said that the chickens have now finally come home to roost. He said that this is such a racist country that we know they kill blacks, but he says the hate in the white man hadn't stopped with the killing of defenseless black people, that hate had been allowed to spread, and now it was so unchecked that it finally struck down the country's chief of state. And he said that is a case of the chicken coming home to roost, and implying, of course, by Kennedy not doing anything, the bullets came his way, and this time they weren't going to do the blacks. They were going to kill the president, and they did. Well, Elijah Muhammad was a compromising black. He was no challenge to the power structure in Chicago. He was organizing the blacks into a fairly mild group, and he didn't like the anger or the honesty of Malcolm X. So he excommunicated him and cut him off, and Malcolm X formed his own sect in New York, and that was the split with the Muslims when he began to face racism as it really is and not as an Uncle Tom appeasing the white people who were deceiving themselves as well as him, and he wasn't deceived. They were actually deceiving themselves. He then went on to Cairo, as I say, where he was very popular, and in July 1964, there was an assassination attempt upon him. He was to give a speech there, and he was given some food with poisoning, and luckily, after dinner, somebody was with him at the time he collapsed. July 24th, he was in his hotel room. He had abdominal pains. They took him to the hospital, and he would have died. His stomach was pumped, and there was an analysis of a toxic substance in his stomach, and only quick care saved him at the time. And he said that somebody deliberately poisoned him, and that there were CIA all around him, and that Washington had a lot to do with it. Of course, he might have known if what he said was right about John Kennedy, and Kennedy was the president and had security, that 6 months later, 7 months later, there's no reason to believe a black leader would be safe in Cairo talking about the United States. He then wanted to go from England to France in February of 65. He had a plan to go there. He was very popular in France, and he had flown to London to address the Council of African Organizations. But when he got to the airport, Orly Airport, he was told February the 9th that he was an undesirable person. The French government told him, and he knew something was wrong. He was baffled because he knew that was wrong, that he was popular there. Then he got information from a high-level North African diplomat that said the intelligence operation told them that they were going to kill Malcolm X in France, and France didn't want this on their soil. Remember the assassination attempt written up in Farewell America to kill Charles de Gaulle, that de Gaulle was forced to get his intelligence agents to find out who was behind it, and then it linked to the people who killed John Kennedy. And at the time of Watergate, the defendants that arrested the Watergate Hotel, two of them were named by persons as being hired to kill John Kennedy in France, and it didn't come off there. It came off in Dallas, Texas. Well, he wasn't allowed to land there because they thought that he would be killed in France, and the French people didn't want to handle that. That was February the 4th. Malcolm X came home to New York City then because he couldn't arrive in France. And February the 12th, 1965, he arrived, and about 10 hours later, when he's with his wife and his children, he had four children asleep at night, his home was firebombed, and the house was totally destroyed, and the exits were marked off, and just luckily, all the children got out of alive. It could have been like the Birmingham, Alabama shooting or bombing of the church when the children were killed in church. Then Malcolm X knew for good the CIA was after him, because they tried to say in the news media, the New York Police Department tried to say that he put a gasoline tank in his own house and that was a hoax to get attention, and that there was a gasoline can on the dresser of his youngest child's room, and he knew he didn't have any gasoline. And then he knew that no longer were the Muslims in America after him. He said, when they planted the gasoline cans, when the firemen came in and the police department came and they planted the gasoline cans, which he didn't own, it was no longer the Muslims that were after me, because only the police department and the CIA or FBI could get into his house after the firebombing, and no Muslims got on the premise. It was closed off. So then he said it's the FBI or CIA, because there was no gas on the baby's dresser and the bomb squad arrived. So he was going to speak at the Audubon Hall in New York City. This is where he was murdered a week later. And he stayed at a hotel in New York, and his wife and children were at another home where they were safe. And he was at this hotel just prior to his assassination the night before, under surveillance, or should be under surveillance, of the police department because of the firebombs and what happened in Paris. But he wasn't protected, and at the hotel, somebody came with a threat for him. He got a phone call of a threat the morning that he was killed. And it sounded scary. The night before, there was a person, several people that came to the hotel where he was staying at the New York Hilton Hotel and asked to see Malcolm X, and the police were called because these people were suspicious characters, later described not as black Muslims but as Cubans. And Malcolm X then was followed, he said, by a Cuban particular man. He described his lips and his eyes, who was on a plane from London to New York. And these same people were at the hotel the night before he was killed, and a Cuban was apprehended by the police the day that Malcolm X was murdered, and then the policeman released him. This is identical to the Dealey Plaza plan, where policemen were seen taking three suspects away when John Kennedy was killed, but the suspects were never registered by the police department, and their names weren't given, and they were allowed to leave town. There was a swarthy gentleman, not a black Muslim at all, described as a Cuban. Now, the Cubans at this time were working for the CIA. Malcolm X was talking in Europe and Africa and America about the Congo, where Lumumba was murdered, and the anti-Castro Cubans were down in Florida, hired by the CIA to take airplanes into the Congo for the Civil War, to tamper with the Civil War down there. And Malcolm X was very vocal about the use of the Cubans. He was followed by Cubans from London, and a Cuban was arrested at the time that Malcolm X was slain, and the police rescued him because the people were jumping on him and saying, he murdered him, and accused him of being one of the four people that shot a gun that day. The policeman saved the man from the crowd, and then he slipped away and was never apprehended again, and we still don't know who he is. It would be interesting to call E. Howard Hunt and his fellow Cubans and find out who was there. He was under constant surveillance by the FBI and the CIA. There's memos of their bugging his telephones, knowing where he was. His phone was tapped, and then he was murdered. A bodyguard that gave mouth-to-mouth resuscitation by the name of Gene Roberts appears at UCLA, where another Black Panther was murdered, John Huggins, again as his bodyguard. And then at the trial of the Black Panthers 21 in New York, the former bodyguard of Malcolm X turns out that he worked for the New York Police Department. Well, my time is up today. I think I would like to do more next week on Malcolm X and the links to Watergate, because I think it's important to see the comparisons between the way the police department handled Malcolm's murder and the way they handled Watergate and the other assassinations.
There is a truth, I thought to myself, while driving down Route 68, a car in front, is there an old, if not behind, it's not a Ford. There is a truth, how things happen, if it was yesterday, it wasn't 1894, and if tomorrow's gonna to come true, there'll be another truth star. For those who think there is no truth, that all depends on point of view. Well, lock us up, fire the bomb, made it only for a gentleman to use. The president, just a choice, he should not incite or claim his fame on November 9th.
Hoping to get the investigation stopped, Attorney General Griffin Bell said today he was shocked at this and wanted it stopped. Carl Stern has a report that the FBI in these cases may have acted on strong suggestions from then Attorney General Mitchell and the White House.
The Justice Department case against FBI agents who allegedly used illegal wiretapping and mail openings in the pursuit of radicals in the early 1970s may be taking a new turn. New evidence that orders for it may have come from as high as the White House. NBC News has learned that the government's top criminal lawyer, Assistant Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti, secretly flew yesterday to New Hampshire to meet with former FBI number three man William Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan, reached by telephone, indicated that he told Civiletti about pressures from the White House that led to setting up the wiretapping and mail openings, circumventing instructions to the contrary from J. Edgar Hoover. At the time, former Attorney General John Mitchell was described as especially upset at anti-government demonstrators, urging that the gloves be taken off, orders which Sullivan told Civiletti he then put into effect. Only one FBI man has been indicted so far, but the new information could lead the Justice Department to reevaluate the wisdom of prosecuting such cases. The Justice Department refused to comment. Civiletti said only that he had been out of town yesterday on official business. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
A Lewis Harris poll asked consumers what they...